Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about a really interesting concept, which is mirror life. And this is the idea that everything on the planet has a certain handedness, like a left-handedness versus a right-handedness. In fact, all living life is left-handed. What if we were to make cells, organisms, animals that were completely right-handed? Is it possible? And should we do that? Is it a good idea? It's something we're going to be answering on the pod in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, tweet us at newstalkscience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the programme. First, though, time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Lara Dungan, immunologist, and Dr. John Regan from the Department of Theoretical Physics at Maynooth University. Our first story has to do with Alzheimer's. And one of the, I suppose, the realizations in the past couple of decades was, Lara, that brain plaques cause Alzheimer's. What is this new study telling us?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a new study, as you just said, from Osaka in Japan. And they looked at patients with Alzheimer's. What we know is that a type of plaque, which is effectively a misfolded protein called amyloid beta, builds up in the brain of people with Alzheimer's. And it, in many ways, kind of clogs up the system, and it causes the brain not to be able to clear out its own waste. It causes damage to the neurons, and it causes this significant neurodegeneration, which is what we see in the disease. And then more recently, disease-modifying drugs have been made for this disease. So what we've always had, or had for a couple of decades, is symptom control drugs. But more recently, we've had a development of disease-modifying drugs. So they target the underlying disease, and one of these is a drug called lecanemab. And it is an antibody that binds to these amyloid beta plaques and theoretically removes them. Now, this new research has looked to see whether the removal of these plaques is actually improving the circulation system in the brain, because even without the plaques, the brain needs to clear out its waste. And as we think we know, is that the plaques build up and they damage this waste clearance system. It's like the lymphatic system in your body, which clears out a lot of your waste. It's called the glymphatic system, in fact. And this research looked at MRI. As we know, MRI has gotten better and better over the last couple of decades. And this particular type of MRI actually looks at this space inside the brain where everything gets cleared out. And what they did was they showed that patients that are on this drug, while we do know that they have reduced amounts of amyloid beta, they didn't show that there was any improvement in this sort of cleaning out effect or this recycling of improper proteins in the brain. Which is a shame. Now, it's a short study. They only looked at 3 months. If you look at the very large controlled trials of this monoclonal antibody, this antibody that removes the amyloid beta, they looked at it over 18 months. And even then, its effect is moderate. The drug is not a fantastic drug. It reduces the how rapidly you are cognitively impaired by about 30%. So it can't turn back time. It can't make you better. It just slows down how quickly you become cognitively impaired, and not even by a huge amount. So this is a quite a short study. It's not done over the same amount of time as the main antibody studies were done, but it seems to show that there's not much physical difference in the brain bar the removal of these protein plaques.
Right. So the drug does remove the plaques, but that's not necessarily giving great relief for Alzheimer's, and it's not solving the problem.
Essentially, it's not really doing the job. And this is kind of what they're saying in this paper.
John, our second story, one of your favorite topics, massive black holes. And this is sort of a bit of a query, because something happened and we struggle to understand. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, so if we go back almost exactly 2 years ago, November 2023, LIGO Virgo Kagra, these are these gravitational wave, ground-based gravitation wave detectors. They detected this merger of two very massive black holes. One of them had a mass 100 times the mass of the sun, so 100 solar masses. And the other one had a mass of 140 times the mass of the sun, so 140 solar masses. And that's okay, except theoretically, they shouldn't exist. Theoretically, they shouldn't exist because we have what's called a mass gap. The mass gap is kind of around 100 solar masses. It's actually between 70 and 140. And within that region, we don't expect black holes to form from the endpoint of stars.
But what would we normally have? We'd either have a collapse and a supernova or what?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. You'd usually get a collapse. You usually get a supernova at the end of the lifetime of a star, or it goes into a black hole. And they're kind of two main things. The tricky thing is there's a mass gap called pair instability supernova, where the supernova just blows everything apart. It just blows out and you get nothing there. And that's the mass gap. But we saw the detectors found the merger of two black holes from the mass gap. And they shouldn't be there because the star should have gone pair instability supernova, so kabling, and everything is gone. No black hole. But
yeah, when you it's funny that you say everything is gone. And when you say everything's gone, there's nothing there, I think black hole. But actually, that's not what a black hole is. Black hole isn't just empty space, of course. It is an entity of nothingness, but on the singularity point, but it isn't just empty space.
No, it has a mass associated with it. That's right.
Yeah.
So that remnant mass should be left there, while the pair of instability supernova will essentially just shred everything and blow it all away, and you get nothing substantial left behind. But LIGO found, or LIGO Virgo Kagra, these gravitational wave detectors, is they found black holes in this mass gap. And that caused a lot of, you know, excitement within the community and trying to understand what, you know, how this could happen. And that's what this research paper from a research group in Manhattan at the Flatiron Institute tried to understand. How could we get black holes within the mass gap?
And did this study sort of manage to come up with a theory as how it happened?
Yeah, so what they've done is they've appealed to magnetic fields. So, and that's not unusual. We expect magnetic fields to be very dominant around black holes, but they're very difficult to model and very difficult to understand. And that's generally, honestly, why they're often neglected in our modeling, because we just don't understand them very well. So
why is that?
It's very hard computationally to actually implement magnetic fields in our models. So it's computationally very expensive and computationally very complicated. And we don't understand.
So we go, look, that is really hard. Let's just not do that bit.
Honestly, yes. Yeah, honestly, yeah.
That's hilarious. Some level,
yeah. And we don't understand also what they're, you know, how important they are. And often that's, you know, a fundamental question. At the zero order, how important are magnetic fields? What this group have found is that if you have magnetic fields threading your black hole or threading your star in advance, it can lead to black holes forming within that mass gap. And that explains how we get these black holes.
All right. Okay. That's kind of cool. But I never realized that. It's kind of funny when physics, you know, there's a bit of that where someone goes, yeah, we just don't deal with that because that's not really useful. Or, you know, look at, you know, standard model, we just leave gravity out of this. It's kind of mad how you can just continue on and just have an enormous elephant in the room, like gravity
fields.
or magnetic fields. Our third story, Lara, has to do with antidepressants, and I was curious by this because it sounded very very appealing in a concept,
doesn't it? Though I actually think that's why it's really important to do a story like this on this show. Because now this isn't the fault of the researchers, you know, they published their paper and they said everything that they should say. But the title of this article is "A Simple DNA Test Could Reveal the Right Antidepressant for You." And I think it's a really good example of why you need to read a story, because this is quite frustrating to me. So what these researchers in Aarhus University in Denmark did is they took a relatively well tried and tested thing called a polygenic risk score. So a couple of decades ago, what we used to have is one genetic, we used to call a mutation, but we're not allowed to say that anymore because it's a microaggression. So now we have to say a variant. But So for instance, if someone has a variant that predisposes them to cystic fibrosis, then they get cystic fibrosis. We've come a long way in genetics since then, and we have these things called polygenic risk scores. So they could be even thousands of tiny little changes in your genetics that might or might not predispose you to a disease. So first of all, they're not simple. It's always a maybe or maybe won't. And this paper has actually taken a polygenic risk score that was made based on hundreds of thousands of people that increases your risk or suggests you have an increased risk of depression or anxiety. And what they did was then they took that to a twin study in Sweden, and they looked to see what drugs people with an increased polygenic risk score for depression and anxiety were on. And that's all they did in this paper. They looked to see what drugs they were on, and they found that people with an increased risk score for depression and anxiety, some of them were on benzodiazepines or antihistamines. That was it. That's really what it showed. And look, it's not to question these researchers. What they showed is the odds ratio which is, you know, one of the ways to show whether there's an increased risk of being on a benzodiazepine or an antihistamine, is about 1.3. So if you take, say, I don't know, the odds ratio for lung cancer and smoking, it's about 20. Whereas an odds ratio of 1 means that there's literally no increased odds. So 1.3 is not astounding or particularly exciting. But all it's saying is that they're on the drug. It doesn't say whether it works. It doesn't say why they're on it. It doesn't give anything else. It just says if you have a slightly increased risk score, you're maybe on this drug. And I find that frustrating. It's not to say the polygenic risk score isn't going to be really exciting, maybe in 5, 10, 20 years time. But this paper in no way is saying you should or shouldn't give a drug, which actually the drugs they found are frankly not as good as the current and more modern drugs for depression and anxiety. So it's just, I suppose, a cautionary tale.
And the study was actually just mapping out what people have certain scores and what antidepressants they're on. That might be useful in 5 years' time to see what the results of those are and see whether or not, you know, if you had a large survey of the polygenic risk score
exactly. And
then the treatment and then whether or not that was really successful for them, then you could probably map something out quite useful. But this was sort of like the beginnings of that rather than anything that we could take from it.
Yeah, no, it's frustrating. And it's not the researchers' fault. They published their research. It's just a cautionary tale. Read the article.
Our final story has to do with space food, John. Always interested in what the astronauts are having up in space and how they chow down at dinner time when they've had a good day floating around in those tin cans. What's this story about?
Yeah, when I first saw it, I was a bit disturbed, I suppose, because it's essentially making protein from whey. So that's what they do here.
From weed?
From whey.
From urea.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I suppose the concept to get across is that when you're in space, mostly the ISS, so like long term on the International Space Station, so long term in space. If you're going on a short orbital trip, it doesn't matter. You can bring whatever you need with you. When you're there for months and weeks at a time, you need a closed loop system. So whatever you have on the spaceship, that's it. And you can't get anything else in, and you don't want to be bringing a lot of food rations with you. So what they do here is they combine in a simple bioreactor, relatively simple, hydrogen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, oxygen and they feed it to a bacteria, and the bacteria produces what's called solein. And solein then you can use effectively as a protein powder. So it's kind of like your protein shakes that you can buy in the shop, and you mix that protein powder into the astronauts' food, and straight away they have a balanced diet. And that's their closed loop system. Yeah, I know it's a bit gross.
So they're extracting proteins from urine. Is there a lot of protein in our urine?
No, they're not getting the protein from the urine. They're getting the nitrogen from the urine.
Right. Sorry. Okay. And there is a lot of nitrogen in urine, that's for sure.
There's lots of nitrogen in there, and that's combined with all of the other your hydrogen and your oxygen and your carbon dioxide, and then the bacteria take that and it produces the protein.
That's not so bad.
Oh, it's not so
if
bad.
You can chemically isolate the nitrogen, I guess. But I thought they were just like sieving through the whey for proteins. Would it retain any sense of flavor? Or, I mean, I guess nitrogen itself is.
Do you mean flavor from the urine?
It's not going to have a flavor. Like, it's not going to taste the whey.
I hope not. Like, I think if it tastes of whey, it's dead, right? Like, there's no way people are going to, like, you know, whether you're on the space shuttle or not, or on the ISS, you're not going to drink whey. Not for long, anyways, right? So, No,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Not for long is a good caveat there, because I was thinking, depends.
No, but I think this is kind of, you know, you have to think about in terms of the long term time they can be on these kind of missions. So if they want to travel to Mars, you know, you're talking 6 months one way, presumably you stay there for a couple of months, and 6 months, 6 to 9 months back. So it's a couple of years minimum. So you're going to need like, you know, a sustainable pathway to producing food. And that's what this closed loop system is designed to do. At the moment, the reactor is about this, the planning one is about the size of a small suitcase. If they need to scale that up, it could be the size of a wardrobe, which that gives them a lot more, of course, choline, protein, that they can mix with their foods to sustain them on their journey.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's a good idea to have, you know, to try and get the most out of everything you have. I mean, sometimes, it, you know, as long as the process makes sense, but sometimes, you know, it just feels like this is just a fun experiment, but really, realistically, no one's ever going to do this. And this, I feel like this might fall into that category, depending on how easy they can extract the nitrogen. I mean, they want to be careful about talking about it, though, because you don't want to be the first space man or woman to have drunk their own urine on the International Space Station. I think Marilyn Monroe admitted that she drank her own wee once and she never let it down.
Well, I think it's actually worse than that. You're drinking kind of, you know, your friend's wee, right?
Okay.
Well, that's what it is.
I mean, I guess so. I guess they're not going to separate everyone's wee. I mean, that makes it even more labor intensive. Do you know what? Let's move on. Dr. John Regan and Dr. Laura Dungan, thank you so much. Imagine a world where life exists, but entirely backwards, where every molecule, every strand of DNA is the mirror image of what it should be. Researchers are already exploring the possibility of creating mirror life, organisms built from the reverse versions of life's building blocks. But what would that mean? Well, Dr. Kate Adamala is Associate Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology and Development at the University of Minnesota. She joins me now. I think you are the first researcher from the University of Minnesota to come on the program, Kate. So you're very welcome.
Then it's my honor.
So I know a little bit about this, but the more I read about it, the less I felt I knew. So let's start off with the basics. When you talk about left hand or right hand or mirrors, what exactly are we talking about?
Every molecule, every complex organic molecules, like the molecules that build our cells, every molecule has a certain shape. And the way those molecules are structured is that they can point one way or another. And there's basically two different options.
What does that mean?
It means if you look at your hands, your left hand and your right hand, they're sort of identical, but they're mirror images of each other, like they're pointing in two different ways. And the same is true for every other molecule. Every complex biological molecule can be like your left hand or your right hand. So they're technically identical, except they're like mirror images of each other. And everything that makes your body can be that.
And so how does that affect... Because molecules, sometimes they click together, don't they? Like,
all the time. That's kind of their whole thing, is to click together with other molecules. That's how cells work.
Right. Okay. So a molecule might sort of have a certain like Lego shape, and it clicks into something else, and then they transfer information between the molecules, or it starts to create stuff like proteins. That's how molecules work.
Yep. Exactly.
God, we're solving all the problems today, and so. Presumably then, if you had a left-handed molecule, it would not be able to do what a right-handed molecule does on a right-handed...
Yes.
You know, in the right-handed world, so to speak.
Exactly. A left-handed Lego brick will click with other left-handed Lego bricks, but not with a right-handed Lego bricks. So you can have those two very similar but not interchangeable sets of Lego bricks that don't work between each other, but work with the ones that are the pointing the same way. So that's the whole idea behind this opposite life.
Why do we have left and right? I'm trying to think in the obviously symmetry is everywhere in nature, but I'm wondering why? Why don't we just have two left hands, two left feet? Why do we need a left and a right at all?
Because it's carbon's fault. Carbon is the atom that is at the center of all organic molecules that make life on Earth. And the way carbon is built kind of enforces that property of molecules, because carbon is not completely symmetrical. If you have four different things attached to a carbon, that's going to create that property of those things attached to carbon can be in different orientations to each other. That's what we call chirality of molecules. And
chirality.
So chirality is the word that describes this pointing left or pointing right. And because of that molecule that's at the center of all of biology, carbon, it can have things attached to it that makes it basically be left-handed or right-handed. That then translates to all of the rest of biology. So go blame carbon.
Right. And so do we have like a mix of these molecules in our body, or in a living organism, would it be mostly left, if you're that sort of an organism, would it be mostly left-leaning molecules?
We don't have a mix, because it would be a hot mess. If you as a living organism have to pick left or right.
What?
There is no way to have mixed.
Really?
Because then imagine the Lego bricks. If you had two different types of Lego bricks and you want to build together at, I don't know, Millennium Falcon or some other giant Lego assembly.
Yeah.
If your Lego bricks don't all agree on which way they're pointing, there is no way you're going to build a complex structure, because they just won't click with each other. So that's why life has to pick.
Right. Oh, well, I guess I was thinking maybe your heart is a lefty bit and then your blood might be a righty bit, but it doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work that way, because it's all starting from one cell. I mean, you used to be one cell back in your mother's ovary. And then that one cell started dividing into all the cells of your body. So once you pick stereochemistry or this chirality, you got to stick with it.
Huh. So are there people out there who are all humans left, or are there some humans who are born right?
More than that, not just all humans, all life on Earth, everything, your dog, bacteria, plants, potatoes, you, your cousin, everything has the same chirality. All life that we know on Earth has the same chirality, because it all is connected, all evolved from one another.
But how do we know that there's a right then? Why do we call it left and right?
Because we made it. We made it in the lab. We can chemically made the other conformation, the other basically type of molecules. And so that's how we know they're possible, because we made them in the lab. They just can't interact with natural cells.
So you've made the like molecules, or like has it gone?
Yep.
Theoretically, from what you're saying, theoretically, you could make living cells.
Theoretically, but yeah, we have not made cells. We only made molecules.
But molecules are building blocks of cells.
Yes.
So what would that mean then for a living, like, this is going to sound really stupid. I mean, presumably it would be visible and like, it would look identical, but...
It would look identical to the naked eye, because we don't see that property of stereochemistry. There's nothing different between a peptide that points one way or another to your eye, but functionally they would be very different.
And so if these molecules are, I mean, I guess it's a fun thought experiment to think, wow, what would happen if we made these molecules that were the opposite but looked identical? But there's no, I mean, is there any point to making them? I mean, apart from that you can?
There is a lot of points, practical applications, because they would not be able to interact with rest of biology, which means predators and viruses would not attack those cells, which means you could do amazing biomanufacturing. So you could basically use them as a platform to produce things, and you would not be susceptible to anything coming from the outside and contaminating your bioreactor.
Until through one thing or another, you accidentally made right-handed viruses or right-handed bacteria.
Yes, that kind of, it would be difficult though. I mean, making a mirror cell would be super difficult too, but because nothing would eat it, nothing would infect it, that's also the reason why we should not be making those cells, because if any accident happens and they happen to be released into the environment, you know, stuff happens, bioreactors leak. If a mirror cell ever leaked into the environment, then it would just live there and nothing would attack it. Nothing would eat it because nothing would recognize it as a proper food, proper living cell. And then it could just spread in the environment. And that's what we're worried about. And that's why we're saying mirror cells shouldn't exist.
I didn't know that's what you were saying. That's cool. I'm going to get to that in a second, but let's just go back a bit. Cells need fuel. Yeah. If they only interact with, say, we're going to say right-handed are the mirror cells that we're talking about. Okay. If they can't feed and can't reproduce because they need to find other cells or other right-handed material, then surely they just disappear.
So those problems are, if you're a cell, those problems are easily solvable. Oh. You reproduce by yourself, so you don't need bodies. Most cells, most single cells, and we're talking really simple bacteria-like cells, those cells reproduce by dividing themselves in half.
But they need fuel.
Yes, they need fuel, and there's plenty of fuel that they can use in the environment. Not all food stock for bacteria is chiral or points one way or another. There is a lot, those so-called achiral. For example, a really easy example, ethanol. A lot of bacteria can utilize ethanol as their food. They can process it, and that's not chiral. There is a lot of other, for example, the simplest amino acid, the only amino acid that's not chiral, glycine, that's plenty of it in the environment. There's a lot of sugars that are not chiral that can be found in the environment and the bacteria can eat it. So that's one, but that's not even, that we're not even done. That's one way, just finding achiral food is one way that bacteria can live. The other way is there are enzymes that can flip this chirality. So in theory, you can imagine a mirror cell that has an enzyme that picks up nutrients from the environment and flips the chirality. Those enzymes exist in nature. So if you made a mirror cell, you could make that mirror version of those enzymes. And so you could imagine having a mirror cell that fends for itself in the wild pretty well.
This is the beginning of horror or a sci-fi movie for sure. But if those enzymes exist in nature, then how come we don't see more just naturally occurring mirror cellular life?
Because it takes too much. Like, to make a mirror cell, you would have to have all of the components, that millions of molecules be of this opposite chirality. And those enzymes don't flip complex molecules. They only flip small, single building blocks. Okay. So there is no enzyme that will take like a whole peptide and flip it to the opposite chirality. It can only do it on single building blocks. And that doesn't get you to a whole cell unless you do it in the lab.
Okay. Well, not without billions of years of evolution, right? Or you do it in a lab, which is what you're saying we should absolutely not do for this reason. But at the same time, is it actually what you're also doing?
I used to be doing that. I used to think...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I used to think we should make mirror cells because the benefits for biology and medicine would be amazing. And I had funded research projects towards building mirror life. And then I started talking to ecologists and evolutionary biologists who I'm none of that. I'm a chemist. I don't have the deep understanding of how ecosystems work. And then I talked to people that do understand that. And they made me realize that if you make an organism that just lives in the environment without being attacked by any predators or viruses, that is a very bad news. That would be terrible for the environment, because we don't want an organism that lives outside of all those regulatory mechanisms that normally guide life. And that's when I realized that I should not be doing what I'm doing. And I switched from saying yay mirror life to saying we absolutely should never make a mirror cell. And that's what I'm advocating for right now.
So this is so interesting that you're like, this is actually could be a really dangerous technology that we don't understand the consequences of it. What is worst case scenario if someone, and it sounds like if you're advocating for us not to do it, it sounds like there are people who are doing it who aren't you. What is worst case scenario if someone starts building mirror life mirror cells that are not found in nature, but identical to biological life, but the reverse. What is the worst case scenario?
Yeah, if a robust mirror cell is ever made and released into the environment, we could see a very slow but very persistent infection spreading through the environment. Because mirror cells are, we call it invisible or stealth to the immune systems, they could infect pretty much anything they want. They could infect potentially plants, animals, and humans. And we can treat humans because we can make a opposite antibiotic, so mirror image antibiotic, and that's going to kill a mirror cell. But you cannot treat the whole of environment. If you have a persistent infection, for example, in a groundwater, it's just physically impossible to treat it. So that would be the worst case scenario, is we would start having this very persistent infection spreading through the environment. And that's why I would rather not get there. I would rather not make a mirror cell and not have to deal with that.
This is so fascinating. So I'm guessing they're mostly men.
Yeah.
But who are the people making mirror cells? Because, you know, through history, there's been a lot of guys who are like, let's just do it because it's cool, not necessarily because it's a good idea. The Oppenheimer question, right? So in this environment, who's making mirror cells, and why are they doing that if this threat that you perceive is a generally accepted threat?
Yeah. So to take away some credit from the guys, I think there's plenty of women that would do it for the heck of it too. It just through the history, we didn't get a chance because, you
That's
know,
true. That's true.
But right now, I can't be 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure right now nobody is actually making mirror cells.
Oh, really?
Because so we published last December, even less than a year ago, we published a paper that's been very wildly noticed, discussed in the both scientific and policy community. It kind of made a splash and people came out and started saying, oh, begrudgingly, some of them, but okay, maybe you're right. And so right now, there is no researcher that's publicly saying they're trying to make a mirror cell. Everyone who worked on it, first of all, most people that used to publicly work on mirror cells are authors on that paper that say, let's not make mirror cells. So they publicly came out and said, okay, we're not doing it. And since we started having those public discussions after that paper, everyone who could, so that has the ability, has the lab with the right expertise to make mirror cells, came out and said, I believe you. And they stopped that particular line of research. So as of now, it's pretty good. That's obviously not going to, you know, we can't be responsible for future generations. We don't know what they're going to do, which is why I want to have laws on the book that says you cannot make a mirror cell. But for now, I'm feeling okay, because people that can make a mirror cell came out and said, I'm not stupid, I'm not going to make a mirror cell.
This is so wild. This is absolutely wild, the story. So, Kate, like, you could have potentially saved the world without even knowing it, right? By writing this paper. That is theoretically possible.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice thought.
But
nice thought.
Whenever someone says, oh, we need to stay away from this, this could be dangerous, my mind goes to the many people who have weaponized such thoughts. And I suppose, is there an easy way for the United States, China, Russia, bad actors, as each of them call each other, to turn this into some sort of a targeted or a serious weapon?
Not really. Obviously, it's possible for a bad actor to try it. But there are two reasons why I'm not particularly worried about weaponizing that technology. So just to be clear, I think bioweapons are absolutely terrifying, but there's plenty of perfectly good natural viruses and bacteria that are much easier to weaponize.
Right.
So if I was a bad actor trying to weaponize something, mirror life would be far down on my list for two reasons. One is because it doesn't exist. So to make a mirror life that's good enough to be a bioweapon, because, you know, you cannot have a wimpy bioweapon. If you want bioweapon, you need something robust. And to make a mirror cell that's robust, it's incredibly difficult. It doesn't exist yet. And we know there would be probably at least a decade, if not more, of work to make it happen. And there are already, you know, there's existing bugs like go weaponize smallpox. That's much better bioweapon.
No, don't go weaponize smallpox.
Don't go.
But I know what you mean. I know what you're saying.
Yeah, that's one reason. The other reason, it would make a terrible bioweapon because you cannot protect your own population. If you make a bioweapon that kills everybody, what kind of bioweapons is that? I mean, that's a doomsday weapon. That's not a good bioweapon. Yeah. So no state actor is going to do that, because they couldn't protect their own people.
Okay. Let me play devil's advocate for a second and talk about basic research that has yielded so much just by understanding. And when we think about mirror cells, there's this entire untapped, ununderstood area of potentially biological life, but a whole realm of scientific discovery that we're just going to decide, no, we're not going to even try to go down that road, even though we don't know where it might lead us. Is that not, you know, from a scientific point of view, a little unsettling to you to leave that chapter just closed, the room dark?
Oh, absolutely. It is unsettling. And it wasn't an easy decision for me to, you know, come out and say that, to say that I don't make mirror life anymore, because it is, you're right, it is one of the most fascinating research problems that I ever worked on. But I also want my kids to have a world to live in. And that's...
Do you think it's that dangerous?
I do think so. I think if all the worst case scenario, it is really concerning. And I cannot tell you 100% for sure that it would be that dangerous. The only way to tell that would be to make it, release it, and wait, see what happens. And that's just not a risk anyone has any right to take. Because if we're wrong, then mirror life will get released and goes, curls up and dies and nothing happens. But if we're right, then mirror life gets released and everyone's screwed. And that's just not a risk anyone should take for any scientific purpose. Science is supposed to make life better, make humanity better, make the planet better. And mirror life, the concerns significantly outweigh the benefits. There is nothing in mirror life that we couldn't get by other types of synthetic biology.
Well, so yeah, so that's the follow-on I was going to ask is, I mean, considering it's a mirror image of a molecule, a mirror image of life, is there anything to suggest that, apart from it, you know, not being able to interact with pilot, is there anything to suggest that it could be useful for anything? I mean, as you say, could we not do everything using just left-handed biological life? Is there any perceived or hypothetical or proposed benefit to having mirror molecules?
Yes, there are benefits, and that's why we were doing it in the first place. There are benefits in using it as a production platform. So making molecules with biology, this whole bioeconomy that's coming to the world because we need it. That could be much easier if you have a mirror bioproduction, because you could make all the molecules you need without worrying that your bioreactor is going to get contaminated.
It's like a perfect clean room.
Exactly. It's a self-contained clean room. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is you could teach a mirror cell to produce a small molecule that's a drug, that's a pharmaceutical. And then if it's invisible to your immune system, you could possibly inject it into a patient and have this little factory, biofactory, circulating in the bloodstream, making a drug. And that would be a really good kind of a personalized medicine solution. But then again, you couldn't contain it. You couldn't control it. So that's why we should, despite it being sounding really good, we should not be going there. We can do all those things that I just mentioned with other types of synthetic cells. We don't need mirror cells to do that.
Man, this is so fascinating.
It's fascinating. And it's also one of the examples of how every research has consequences. We can't just assume something is safe or good because we think the benefits are good.
Yeah, you got me thinking now. I'm going to spend a bit of time thinking about this today, I think. It's like it depends on how you use it, right? Really interesting. Associate Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology and Development at the University of Minnesota, Kate Adamala. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So looking back at some of your comments from last week now, we spoke to Professor Jane Aspel from the Anglia Ruskin University. She's a professor of neuroscience there, and talking about recovering lost memories by perhaps looking at a version of ourselves that is young. Someone says, I wonder in terms of the memories that came up, did it depend on how old the participant was at the time of their memory? If they were older in the memory, were they able to give more detail, for example? That's a good question. And, you know, how old the person is and how old the memory was, I suppose, are crucial, really. Another person says, ooh, could this technique possibly be adapted to retrieve memories from childhood amnesia, like before 3 or 4? You know, getting memories from those ages are, as you pointed out, that the point of childhood amnesia is it's very difficult to remember those things. I actually don't know why that is. We must do a program or an episode on that. Why do we just not remember before then? It's obviously something to do with our brain development. But I feel that the persistence of this curtain to our past, you know, anything before 3 or 4, would make me believe that even with suggestion and using this technique, it's probably unlikely because of how the memories are formed and kept and how meaning is added to those memories and encoded. Joe says, did your team analyze how long the enhancement effect had lasted? For example, if someone experiences the illusion today, will their memory retrieval still be boosted days or weeks later, or is it very transient? I didn't ask you that. We might follow up and ask. My guess is it's probably very transient. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Maurice O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
Life is unpredictable. But how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's policygenius.com.